Atlas wiedzy, czyli jak pokazać to, co symbolizują liczby. Czy mapy nauki to nowoczesny pomysł? Dlaczego wiedza przedstawiana jest w taki właśnie sposób? Jakie są owoce prezentacji owych map na wystawie nazywanej Places and Spaces? O tym wszystkim w drugiej części rozmowy z profesor Katie Borner. Katie Borner, ekspert w zakresie inżynierii i nauk o informacji, jest profesorem na Uniwersytecie w Bloomington. Jest jednocześnie autorką licznych publikacji i wspaniale wydanych albumów, a właściwie trylogii przedstawiającej mapy nauki. Indeks Hirsza dla tej publikacji wynosi 53 punkty, a liczba cytowań to ponad 16 tysięcy. Rozmowa odbyła się w lipcu 2023 roku w Bloomington w stanie Indiana, gdzie spotkali się naukowcy na cyklicznej międzynarodowej konferencji naukometrycznej International Conference of Scientometrics and Infometrics. Patronem tego spotkania było Światowe Towarzystwo Info i Naukometryczne ISSI. Przypomnijmy, że w rozmowie tej uczestniczyła pani profesor Wiesława Osińska, specjalista w dziedzinie wizualizacji danych i informatologii, autorka licznych publikacji i książek naukowych, wykładowca w UMK w Toruniu. To właśnie profesor Osińska jest ambasadorem wystawy Places and Spaces, która prezentuje mapy nauki stworzone przez międzynarodowe zespoły uczonych. W tej części rozmowy zajmiemy się specyfiką trylogii pod wspólnym tytułem Mapy nauki – Atlas of Knowledge. Posłuchamy o tym, co doprowadziło do takiego przedsięwzięcia, jak to się stało, że księgi te zostały wydane przez wydawnictwo MIT i co zainspirowało Spiritus Movens, czyli Katie Borner, do takiego właśnie prezentowania informacji naukowej. Przed Państwem rozmowy część druga. Zapraszam, Mira Jankowska.
There are three Atlas books, and because it's three, it's a trilogy, and the three atlases together, they have all 100 maps, which have been created by more than 240 researchers around the globe, which over the last 10 years have submitted their best works to the exhibit, and then an international team of reviewers gets to decide which of the 10 maps is the best and is also most insightful and most actionable for policymakers, for experts, for scholars, and even for children. We had an exhibit for children on exhibit maps. And for that particular iteration, we actually had children being reviewers. And children are very honest. If they don't understand that map, the map doesn't make it in. And so it's a wonderful piece of my life that we get to interact with all these experts around the globe that deeply care about bringing data into people's minds and hearts in a way that they can understand it. And then also bringing the exhibit to many, many public libraries, to national science foundations, to many public venues where children and their parents and their caregivers and their other family members and of course also experts can look at them and ideally find their own place in science, can discuss them, can critique them, can learn from them, and in some cases, actually in many cases, then reach back out to the mapmaker team to understand how these maps were done. And in some cases, they also then feed their own data into the same data analysis workflow to then see their own data in that same mapping framework. And I think that's really wonderful to see, because then it's not just looking at a data set, but really seeing your own data set in a new way. And so in the books, you have the Atlas of Science, which explains how science mapping came about. It also has a long timeline of science mapping. And it has many, many examples of how you can map something as complex and as abstract as science. You also have the map of knowledge that explains how data visualizations are constructed in a very, very systematic way. It features the data visualization framework that basically empowers anyone to turn data into actionable insights. And then the third atlas, the Atlas of Forecasts, introduces different ways to predict futures using experts, using forecasting, but also using computational predictive models. And 10 computational predictive models are explained in the book with many, many examples. And it's quite interesting to see how these predictions are used to pick desirable futures. So you can change parameter values to understand what happens if you fund this type of work and not another work. And then you can discuss what happens and you can make a more intelligent decision on how to use limited resources. And sometimes it's not funding, maybe sometimes it's just connecting the right person to the right other person in the moment of time that it's needed. And or giving somebody a good book to read, that could also be needed in some cases and make a huge difference. So I think it's not just about money, it's in many cases connecting good people to each other. It's getting them connected to data, to software artifacts, to new methods, to new approaches, to new ways of seeing this world. That makes a huge difference in how history unfolds. And so hopefully these maps can help a little bit to showcase not just the past of what has happened so far, or what is happening currently, which is also important to understand, for instance, for young scholars, which are still trying to understand where in this space of science they might like to live, but also for understanding possible futures and ultimately picking the best future, which is non-trivial because there are many, many different futures which are very dystopian. You really don't want them. And so picking good futures is non-trivial and should be done in a data-driven way.
These books have highly aesthetic value, nice published. And I think this attracts readers. Publishing by MIT on the paper, special paper, format, colors.
And it's a great pleasure to create these atlases because you have full freedom of what goes in on each double page spread. And the atlas books are designed in a way that whenever you open a new page, there's a new topic. And ideally you go like, wow, what is that now? And then you open the next page and you're like, wow, another piece. And I think that's intended. This is really intended and we spend much time to get our hands on the best quality data sets, algorithms, and of course data visualizations to construct text that is understandable to general audiences. And ideally it's actionable. Ideally it gets to your emotions a little bit, because if it only gets to your intellect and you understand it but you don't feel it and you don't care, then it's not going to change your behavior. And so it's quite important that people feel touched by the data, feel touched by these visualizations, and ideally also feel touched by the experts that poured a little bit of their life and their heart and their hopes and dreams for this world into these maps.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, it was difficult to convince publishing MIT publisher to publish this book.
Actually, it wasn't. We initially had Esri as a publisher, and that was fully confirmed. But then, because Esri publishes map books, right? And these are maps. But then they realized that we couldn't provide for every data layer full provenance in terms of data sets and algorithms used. And this is very standard for geospatial maps, but not possible currently for maps of science. And so they couldn't publish this anymore because it wasn't up to their standards. And so we approached MIT Press, and at that moment in time, we did have a sample in hand. And they were actually very, very interested to publish. And we were extremely happy with that collaboration. And so The Atlas number 2 and 3 were published with MIT Press. We currently are working on Atlas number 4, which is the Atlas of Macroscopes. And there might be two more atlases before I retire. So I think this is just a wonderful collaboration with the MIT Press team. And we get to see everything in-house. So we lay out the entire book in-house and then share the print-ready files with MIT Press. So we have really full control of what goes where. And this makes it a true pleasure to work on these projects.
Nice collaboration.
Yeah, absolutely phenomenal.
Could you tell us, please, a little bit about exhibitions of these maps? Mm-hmm. Because I've heard that it happens in all over the world, yeah?
Yeah, so we have brought the exhibit to more than 60 countries. And it's just wonderful to see how the exhibit is received by so many different experts, but also ultimately general audiences or scholars from other disciplines. I think it really helps bridge this gap between social sciences and hardcore sciences and engineering and the arts and humanities, because they all get to see each other on these large-scale general maps of science. And they get to understand the values that they bring for each other, and they get to see how people like me make it through many, many different continents on the map of science. But then ultimately also these maps go to many geospatial continents on our world map and get to inspire and encourage different audiences to make their very own maps. So I think I'm very, very happy that people don't just consume these maps and enjoy an evening with just beautiful aesthetic data visualizations, but they really get inspired to make their own data visualizations, to download data sets, to try out code, try out tools, which make it very, very easy now to read in a data set and visualize. Maybe too easy in some cases, because it's just a button click away. But then also get to critique these visualizations and ask for more, and then connect out to experts which can help them enhance their existing algorithms or tools to get better and better insight into the data and answer more and more interesting questions. And in many cases, ask new questions, which is really the major part about data visualization. If the data visualization is well done, it disappears. You just get to see the data, the structures, the trends, the patterns, the outliers, and you get to ask new questions about your data, which oftentimes means that you have to download a new data set or construct a new data set, gather a new data set, and then get new algorithms implemented to now answer the next question. But I think that's really a true joy to see so many people embrace data visualizations in their lives and become data visualization experts in some cases. Yeah.
How it happened that you find this concept that we can use maps as a visualization of the data? Because it's a step, big step, yes, in thinking. It is a new idea. So how it happened?
So in the Atlas of Science, there's a long, long timeline of the very early maps of science, which are not from me. This was way before I was born. So it started very small, with much smaller data sets, much fewer nodes and edges, much fewer coverage of areas of science. But over time, I think people really enjoyed having that bird's eye view of our collective scholarly knowledge. And so the area and the tools and the data sets grew over time, and they attracted more and more scholars, including myself, to then take some of those maps and frame them and bring them in the exhibit, but also to help advance some of the data sets and algorithms that are needed to create more easy to read and also more actionable data visualizations.
And the history of science map is presented in the first book.
Yes. And again, there's Moreno also. I mean, there's Garfield's work and Henry Small's work, but that goes way back in time. So I think it's best to maybe if you are here in that moment of the interview, just go to page that and that, I don't have the page in my head right now, in the Atlas of Science, and just browse through the next 13 pages so that you have 26 full page spreads, right, to really look at the timeline. And it's super interesting to see how initially papers got published, but then the data sets became more easily available, were even productized with the Web of Science, Garfield's Web of Science, ISI database, and same for algorithms. So they first were used in a research setting, but then became professional tools that you could just download, in some cases even had to purchase, because now there was production support behind. And over time, you have a much more robust infrastructure to create these science maps on a large scale and in a much easier way. So what used to take months of times, now you can do in a day.
You said that you receive a PhD in artificial intelligence. Could you tell us, what do you think about artificial intelligence? There is a lot of different opinions and thoughts about this new possibility. What is your view in this matter?
So we just had a great panel here at ISI that actually had many good comments on that very topic. So you might like to go back to the recording. It's recorded. It will be made available. I believe there are problems that humankind is facing that cannot be solved using human intelligence alone. So it will require very close collaboration and synergies between machine intelligence, artificial intelligence, and human intelligence. And just like you have to teach a teenager what to do and what not to do, and sometimes you can and sometimes you cannot anymore because it's a teenager. Similarly here, I think we will have to find ways to generate training data sets that can be used by machine learning algorithms to go the extra mile, to do something that human minds are not able to do. But then the combination of human and machine intelligence will help us solve certain issues. And similarly also for the understanding of a complex dynamic system such as science itself, it's very beneficial to bring in different machine learning algorithms or different computational predictive models. So the Atlas of Forecasts actually features and introduces 10 different computational predictive models that can be used and have been used to understand the structure and dynamics of science. And one of them is also machine learning and deep learning, which has recently made a lot of news headlines with ChatGPT and other large language models. And so again, I think there is an opportunity here to use machine learning very intelligently to augment our human abilities. There's also, I think, a lot of good discussion about how to make sure that we are not superseded by machine intelligence. And there was a lot of good comments made in the panel. So I think you might like to go back to the panel and review that material there. And I was very proud that we could have that panel here at the ISI conference, because I believe in 2 years, at the next ISI conference, the 20th ISI conference, there will be many, many papers that deal with that issue, because it will have a huge impact on how quickly and how in what structure science is evolving in the next 2 years and beyond that. And it will also have a huge impact on how we collaborate with each other and with machine learning algorithms. So if I predict, I would say 20-30% of all the papers at the next ISI conference most likely will have some kind of machine learning aspect. Just like at this conference, you had quite a few papers that dealt with the impact of COVID on the scholarly enterprise.
Talking about artificial intelligence provoked me to ask also about our not only human intelligence, but human, how to say it, way of being. I'm thinking also about our possibilities to be artists, to create a lot of things. And what is our human being issue or task in this era of humanity?
You know? I think I know the question. So we did some recent work with James Evans' team on skills discrepancies. And what we did there was to compare and contrast the scientific and patent landscape, with the educational landscape, with the job market landscape. And if you look at skills that are demanded by the job market, and you see what is taught, what skills are taught in the classroom setting, and you also look at skills that appear in scholarly publications, there are differences there, and there are delays in the system of how quickly a job skill is demanded and how quickly it is taught in a classroom setting, and similarly also how quickly a new innovation is researched in an academic setting and how quickly it then makes it into classroom teaching. And so understanding these delays and also understanding how the job market changes as AI and robotics and automation come in is super important, because you want to advise the next generation in terms of what they should learn, what career trajectories are going to be available to them, and which ones are now taken on by robots or by AI. And so in that particular paper, we showed that as robotics and AI and automation come in, the social skills, the human skills, the communication skills become much, much more valuable, because they're still needed, but they can't be fulfilled yet by some of the more automatized means. And so I highly recommend you all to read that paper, but you might also like to just link to it from the podcast. I assume you will have metadata coming with it, so be free to ask me for all these links.
Thank you very much for this conversation. And I hope that someday you will come, not only to Warsaw, but also to Toruń. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. It was a pleasure also.
Bohaterką tego wywiadu była profesor Katie Borner, światowej klasy, ekspert w dziedzinie inżynierii i nauk o informacji, popularyzatorka i badaczka map nauki. Rozmowa została przeprowadzona na Uniwersytecie w Bloomington w stanie Indiana w lipcu 2023 roku przy okazji Międzynarodowej Konferencji Naukometrycznej. Spotkania z tej klasy naukowcami są zawsze przywilejem i dają nadzieję, że uczelnie, które dysponują tak wyśmienitym zespołem naukowców, mają szansę na dalszy świetny rozwój i współpracę. Dziękuję za przywilej rozmowy zarówno z profesor Katie Borner, jak również z panią profesor Wiesławą Osińską. Mira Jankowska.